Chapter 10, Vietnam. In the 1960s, the U.S. military made Southeast Asia the testing ground for a new generation of chemical weapons like napalm and dioxin containing herbicides like Agent Orange. By May 1967, Deputy Secretary of Defense Cyrus R. Vance acknowledged to a Senate disarmament subcommittee that the United States was actively developing chemical and biological weapons. That year, the United States aggressively beat back a United Nations proposal to criminalize the use of all gases for offensive purposes. The Army and Special Forces were by then widely deployed I need to get myself into a better position for light. Okay, here we are. Let's start that sentence again. The Army and Special Forces were by then widely deploying tear and nausea gas weapons to clear Viet Cong tunnels. United States officials argued that the 1925 Geneva Protocol did not specifically cover non-lethal gases, and that, besides, the United States government was using the same weapons back at home against its own citizens when they engaged in civil rights or anti-war protests. Agent Orange. The United States also argued that the 1925 agreement did not cover herbicides like Agent Orange. The paperclip scientist Fritz Hoffman had pioneered the study of dioxin during his years with the Reich and boasted that he played a key role in developing Agent Orange for the CIA. Many scientists regard dioxin as one of the world's most dangerous non-radioactive molecules. A U.S. military project, Operation Ranch Hand, was at that moment blanketing Vietnam's forests and farm fields with 20 million gallons of various defoliants, codenamed Agent Pink, Agent Green, Agent Purple, Agent Blue, and the dioxin-based Agent Orange, to rob the Viet Cong of their food and hiding places. The Pentagon purchased tens of millions of dollars worth of defoliants and herbicides from 9 companies, including Dow Chemical and Monsanto, enough for 12,000 sorties by Air Force C-123 and Monsanto. Air Force C-123 stealth planes, each carrying a 1,000-gallon, 10,000-pound load. Each 4-minute sortie defoliated 300 acres of cropland and forest. Ranch Hand's commander, Air Force Major Ralph Dresser, told reporters that his group's slogan was, quote, "Only we can prevent forests," end quote. In total, the U.S. Chemical Brigade defoliated over 5.5 million acres, about 24% of South Vietnam, dropping enough Agent Orange to cover and destroy 5 million acres of upland forest and 500,000 acres of food crops. The affected area had a size approximately equal to that of Massachusetts. As of 2015, nearly 4.8 million Vietnamese citizens were exposed, causing 400,000 deaths and another million disabilities or other health problems. Some 300,000 American military veterans have died from Agent Orange exposure, nearly 5 times the 58,000 who died in combat. Not surprisingly, prior to deploying Agent Orange and its uber carcinogenic component dioxin on U.S. soldiers, the Vietnamese, their food, and their landscapes, the sociopaths at Fort Detrick, first experimented with the chemical using prisoners at the Holmesburg State Prison in Philadelphia. The Army subsequently studied those men for development of cancer, indicating that the military's chemical corps suspected Agent Orange was a carcinogen from the outset, something that military brass and Confederates at CDC initially denied under oath. Perjured congressional testimony and a litany of fraudulent studies allowed the mastermind of the Agent Orange cancer cover-up, a CDC official named Colleen Boyle, to shield the Veterans Administration from paying benefits for cancer and other dioxin-induced injuries to U.S. soldiers for nearly a decade. My uncle Senator Edward Kennedy's Senate committee finally exposed that fraud, and Boyle left the post in disgrace. CDC immediately moved her to the agency's National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, where Boyle was promoted to director in 2010, and where she managed the cover-up of the overwhelming science linking epidemics of childhood neurological and autoimmune diseases, including autism, to the expanded childhood vaccination schedule. Wow, that's powerful. I'm sorry to just editorialize here. That's chapter 10. It's only 2 pages. Chapter 11, reservations about bioweapons development from within the military. In his seminal book, Chemical and Biological Warfare, America's Hidden Arsenal, investigative journalist Seymour M. Cy Hirsch observes that some of the most vocal opposition to the U.S. biological weapons program came from Pentagon strategists worried that they were developing weapons that could be turned against the United States with devastating effect. These critics argued that germ weapons were cheap to culture and manufacture and easy to disperse, giving poor nations and non-state malefactors nuclear weapons equivalents on a busman's budget. One top planner told Hirsch, "It's a weapon that's not to the United States' advantage to have." Another scientist explained that chemical and biological weaponry places enormous emphasis on surprise, covert use, and attacks against large populations. What we're doing with the research is making this stuff a gift to other countries. We just may end up being a target for sneak attacks against our cities. In 1960, Major General Stubbs warned a congressional committee that a foreign enemy could kill or seriously disable 60 million Americans in an attack with only 10 aircraft dispensing dry biological agents. We feel that 10 carriers distributing 10,000 pounds each could mount such an attack, Stubbs said. With dry biological warfare material, we feel a potential enemy would get at least 30% casualties in the total of the United States. The weapons biowarfare skeptics also argued that biological weapons also always carry the risk of catastrophic blowback, the so-called boomerang effect, even when the good guys initiate an attack. Furthermore, if a virulent germ with engineered superpowers escaped from the lab during peacetime, it could trigger a doomsday machine that would not spare humans anywhere on Earth. They pointed out that while chemical weapons were self-limiting, every use of an infectious biological weapon threatens to unleash a global pandemic with cataclysmic impacts on humanity and nature. Once you deploy them, you have lost control of their trajectory. They are coming back to bite you, Dr. Francis A. Boyle told me. Dr. Boyle is America's leading authority on bioweapons regulations. A professor, attorney, and advocate of international law, Boyle drafted the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, BWATA. American legislation implementing the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention, discussed in later chapters. Both houses of the United States Congress unanimously passed his BWATA before President George H. Bush signed it into law. Dr. Theodore Rosebery, a bacteriologist, who did bioweapons research at Fort Detrick during World War II, echoed Boyle's warning. Quote, "The horrible potentialities of bioweapons that the gamesmanship and brinksmen seem to enjoy playing with are modified by uncertainties they seldom stress. For one thing, it is next to impossible to know beforehand what to expect from a strategic bioweapons attack. There is no satisfactory way of testing it in advance." End quote. Even as they filled their laboratories and armories with increasingly lethal concoctions, colonies, and cultures, Pentagon critics fretted about the unpredictability of their weapons. Writing in a scientific journal in 1964, Dr. Leroy D. Fothergill, one-time director of the Fort Detrick Labs, warned of the devastating impacts of unleashing biological weapons on humanity and the planet. Quote, "Everything that breathes in the exposed area has an opportunity to be exposed to the agent. This will involve vast numbers of mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and insects. Various natural history surveys have indicated surprising numbers of wildlife inhabiting each square mile of countryside. It is possible that many species would be exposed to an agent for the first time in their evolutionary history. We have no knowledge of the range of susceptibilities of these many species of wildlife to specific microorganisms, particularly through the respiratory route of administration of infectious aerosols. What would be the consequences?" End quote. By 1969, the United States Bioweapons Program had developed weapons of a nuclear equivalence, according to David Franz, former commander of the United States Army Medical Research and Material Command at Fort Detrick. The principal limitation, Franz acknowledged, was the difficulty of managing bioweapons so as to prevent accidental escape. Ironically, Franz would later play a key role in the Pentagon Fauci gain-of-function programs leading up to the COVID-19 pandemic. As part of their bioweapons development, Fort Detrick scientists were researching 17 vaccines against the diseases they were creating. Vaccines, after all, were a necessary feature of every offensive bioweapon. Because of the boomerang effect, says Dr. Boyle, you can't use a bioweapon against your enemy without having in your possession an anecdote with which to shield your own team from blowback. For this reason, bioweapons and vaccines are always developed in tandem with each other. In the late 1960s, momentum built among military strategists, health advocates, and others to adopt a robust ban on research, development, and possession of biological and chemical weapons. The chemical cartel, far better organized and politically connected, mounted a concerted propaganda campaign to safeguard its profits and power interests. The Chemical Corps was, by then, producing thousands of tons of sarin annually, 365 days, 24 hours a day, loading it into artillery shells, aerial bombs, rockets, and warheads for missiles. The advertising push sought to frighten Americans with the threat of Soviet gas attacks into believing we needed the chemical warfare industry to maintain an American arsenal. Right now, you and your family, all of us, are unprotected against the threat of a terror weapon which could prove more deadly than an atomic bomb, the advertising warned Americans of a Pearl Harbor-type attack with an odorless, colorless, tasteless nerve gas designed to destroy people with paralyzing suddenness, unveiling what have now become standardized propaganda tropes with which intelligence agencies terrorize Americans into funding their weapons projects. Chemical Corps Chief Major General E.F. Boleyn parroted that tread-worn trope that the only defense was offense. The only safe course is to be ready to use gas in overpowering quantities. This rationale, of course, ignored Americans' overwhelming nuclear weapons domination. It paralleled the same nonsensical self-serving argument that germ warriors use today, that the only way to stop germs is to make more of them. Chapter 12. The Biological Weapons Convention. It all ended, seemingly, in late 1969, when President Nixon announced the unilateral termination of the American biowarfare system, invoking both moral and strategic reasons. President Nixon was openly contemptuous of germ warfare, dismissing it as useless and potentially dangerous. He recognized that biological weapons were a strategic crapshoot because of their inefficiency in combat, where instant deaths are strategic necessary. Where instant deaths are a strategic necessity, the difficulty controlling their trajectories, and the high risk of blowback on U.S. military units and civilians. His Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, shared the view, pointing out that the United States could easily deter weapons used by an enemy using its arsenal of superior chemical, nuclear, and conventional weapons. Nixon observed that mankind already carries in its own hands too many of the seeds of its own destruction. Nixon's action reflected the finest of America's values, including our national tradition of idealism, and fortified our claim to global leadership as a moral authority. Nixon's idealistic move was also a shrewd tactic by a master geopolitical strategist. The United States, after all, already had the world's dominant nuclear weapons arsenal and the most advanced delivery systems. The 1968 Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons had created an effective monopoly on weapons of mass destruction, limited to the nuclear powers. Nixon wanted to prevent third world countries and non-state terrorists from acquiring nuclear equivalency via access to comparatively inexpensive bioweapons, which strategists viewed as the poor man's atom bomb. Probably seeing the same advantage, the other nuclear powers immediately supported the treaty, further enabling the nuclear weapons states to maintain their near monopoly on weapons of mass destruction. President Nixon's statement on chemical and biological defense policies and programs unconditionally ended all U.S. offensive biological bioweapons program. Sorry, let me read that again. President Nixon's statement on chemical and biological defense policies and programs unconditionally ended all U.S. offensive biological weapons programs. Nixon ordered the destruction of U.S. anti-personnel, biological agents, and munitions, a process that the Army ostensibly completed in 1972 at an estimated cost of $12 million. In 1975, the Pentagon turned the virus section of Fort Detrick's Center of Biological Warfare Research Laboratory over to the NIH and the National Cancer Institute, NCI, for cancer research. Nixon next cajoled Major powers to join the United States in signing the Biological Weapons Convention, BWC, the first multilateral disarmament treaty to ban the production and stockpiling of an entire category of weapons of mass destruction. In 1975, the U.S. officially ratified both the BWC and the Geneva Protocol, the latter following a 50-year delay. As of June 2023, 185 states have become parties to the Biological Weapons Convention. Let's go one more chapter. Chapter 13. Evading Geneva and the Bioweapons Charter. The loophole. While the Biological Weapons Convention forbids research on offensive bioweapons, it allows development of pathogenic microorganisms so long as the project's promoter makes the obligatory claim that they intend this invention to serve peaceful or defensive purposes like vaccines, and only a small quantity is produced. This is the so-called dual-use loophole. In 1989, Colonel David Huxall, then commander of the Army's Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, or AMRIID, at Fort Detrick, indicated that offensive and defensive research look alike as far as the laboratory techniques used. He believed that they could ultimately be distinguished based on the data that are generated and compiled. And Dr. Merle Nass argued in 1991 that using Huxall's criteria, DOD's Biological Defense Research Program, BDRP, was doing offensive work. Since almost every step for advancing new bioweapons can masquerade as vaccine development, the bioweapons cartel has used this loophole to mask a vast global enterprise of bioweapons development under the pretext of making vaccines. Furthermore, unlike many other arms treaties, which come with a host of inspection and enforcement capabilities, the BWC included no provisions for site inspection enforcement and no penalties for noncompliance. There is no oversight body with investigatory... There is no oversight body with investigatory capability or powers to assign penalties. All of these deficiencies mean that there are no repercussions for violators. The problem, Francis Boyle told me, is that the BWC had no teeth. The international treaty went into force in 1975 with a plan to negotiate a regime for inspections and sanctions afterwards. But U.S. diplomats have repeatedly blocked every effort by other nations to negotiate or implement safeguards or to otherwise strengthen the Biological Weapons Convention. CIA defiance. Nixon's bold action shocked the chemical and biological warfare cartel. Dr. Boyle recalls the predictable reaction of the bioweapons community to Nixon's surprise announcement as incredulity mixed with anger. Boyle says that this cohort never relinquished their dreams of resuming their program of perfecting America's bioweapons arsenal. Most ominously, there lurked in the bowels of the Pentagon the remnants of the old chemical and biological warfare, CBW unit, waiting, wishing, hoping, and planning. Waiting, wishing, hoping, planning, and scheming to spring back into life. That's a quote. So let me read this quote again. Most ominously, there lurked in the bowels of the Pentagon the remnants of the old chemical and biological warfare, CBW, unit, waiting, wishing, hoping, planning, and scheming to spring back into life. The CIA's reaction to President Nixon's 1969 ban on chemical and biological weapons was to classify its illegal experiments as top secret and continue developing its biological weapons under clandestine cover. The CIA never took the BWC seriously, says Boyle. Before the Army destroyed its bioweapons arsenal at Fort Detrick in 1972, Sidney Gottlieb drafted a secret proposal for CIA operatives from the laboratory's special... I'm sorry, this is a little aside here. Do your eyes when you read sometimes ever go jump ahead to the next paragraph or some, not the paragraph, but the sentence? Anyway, sorry, let me go back. Oh, I'm laughing at myself. Sometimes I feel like my words aren't coming out as fast as my eyes see the words. Okay. Before the Army destroyed its bioweapons arsenal at Fort Detrick in 1972, Sidney Gottlieb drafted a secret proposal for CIA operatives from the laboratory's Special Operations Division to spirit off cultures of the Army's most deadly weaponized pathogens, including stockpiles of smallpox, anthrax, tularemia, Venezuelan equine's encephalitis, cocidiomycosis, valley fever, brucellosis, tuberculosis, chlorine-resistant salmonella, food poisoning, staphylococcus food poisoning, borrelia, paralytic shellfish poison, lethal cobra and crate snake venom, microcystitis. That's not it. Microcystis, intestinal flu, botulism, and saxitoxin, paralytic shellfish poison. A couple years later, investigations would find one of these biotoxins, saxitoxin, stashed in a Navy chemical warehouse in Washington, D.C. It was 2 years before we signed the BWC that CIA Director Richard Helms ordered the agency's records of its bioweapons atrocities destroyed. Quote, "The agency operated in extreme secrecy thereafter," says Boyle. "Historians, therefore, have only fleeting glimpses of the CIA's outlaw biowarfare activities after the signing of the Bioweapons Convention. However, sporadically leaked documents hint at the spy agency's ongoing commitment to research and development of illegal weapons. For example, between 1997 and 2000, the CIA teamed with the Bartel Memorial Institute, teamed with the Battelle Memorial Institute in an audacious and super secretive illegal program codenamed Project Clear Vision to construct and test an anthrax bomb. In another project, around the same time, the Pentagon drew up plans to genetically engineer a weaponized version of anthrax to assess whether the vaccine now being given to millions of American soldiers is effective against such a superbug. The projects arguably were capital crimes under the Geneva Protocol, carrying the death penalty. So naturally, both the CIA and Battelle illegally omitted reporting their clandestine and criminal activity in the U.S. Biological Weapons Convention mandatory reporting declarations that the United States government submitted to the UN later that year. Soviet progress. The CIA's clandestine pursuit of the bioweapons program and relentless U.S. opposition to all efforts to equip the BWC with teeth had at least one unintended blowback: the expansion of a parallel Soviet program. According to Francis Boyle, The Soviets knew that after the Nixon order, the CIA, the Pentagon, Fort Detrick simply moved their offensive biological programs underground and or continued them covertly under the rubric of quote-unquote defense. So, the Soviets reciprocated in kind and set up their own covert offensive biological warfare weapons program in violation of the BWC. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union, United States military and intelligence agencies launched a massive post-Cold War version of Operation Paperclip to recruit Soviet bioweaponeers and capture their pathogen cultures. We and the Brits milked all the Soviet biowarfare experts for everything they could give us in order to convert to our own use, says Boyle. Wow. And that's the end of chapter 13. We'll start with chapter 14 next time, and it's called The Critical Role of Vaccines in Bioweapons Development. Thanks for listening.